So this is the Word. The Word is the vibration that has empowered this entire cosmos to come into creation. So it's really something. Through this knowledge, Jesus was able to eat of food that his disciples knew not of. They would eat oftentimes and he would not, and yet he was full of life, full of power, full of energy. By learning to depend more on this cosmic energy entering in through the medulla, you are able to take your life force in this way. Also, through higher and advanced techniques, he was able to materialize and dematerialize his body at will. So there's those times when he upset the different ruling officials at the time, and it is said that he passed through their midst, but they saw him not. He was able to make himself disappear at those times. And so with these great masters, through this knowledge of the life force, where we originate from, where our power comes from, they're able to do these tremendous feats. So we start out with learning in our own body, how our body is materialized, how it has come into being. Now we start out in creation as a thought, a projected thought. And through that thought comes our energy body or our astral body. And from that materializes this physical manifestation, this physical body. When you do these energization exercises, it tends to take you into the astral. In other words, you feel this tingling life force move through you. Now, when you become more attuned to it and more advanced, you will feel as if your whole body is this vibrating energy, this vibrating life force, and it feels less and less dense, less and less material, but more and more like pure energy. When you go beyond that, even in your own realization, then you come to the idea that your body is but a fragment of an idea that has been projected out from the original spiritual source. And finally, in total liberation, you realize this is nothing but spirit, that the idea, the energy, and the physical manifestations are all pure spirit. And not only that, but this entire creation is spiritualized, and you see it as nothing but vibrating spirit everywhere that you look. And this contains peace and bliss and upliftment. So you see, we're really made of something quite marvelous, only we don't know it. We tend to become so focused just on this body and what it needs, and our identity as a human being, that we don't take the time to go deeply into the laboratory of our own souls and discover who and what we truly are. So let us begin by this energization exercise which was developed by Master Yogananda. He said the body is like a battery and it can be recharged. Now normally we think of recharging ourselves by eating food or breathing in more deeply in oxygen. And while these things are importantly critical to us as human beings, spiritually we have access to the source of divine life force flowing in through us. So with each tension and relaxation, through your power of imaging in your own mind, image this life force, feel it and imagine it coming in through the medulla, being guided down through the nervous system, and for instance, with the first one, being guided into the left foot. So I will say to tense it low, medium, and high. That is, you put a little tension in it, more tension, and then the highest amount of tension. And in that time, that part of your body should be vibrating. Try to focus it in as much as you can on that part of your body only. Then when I say relax and feel, feel that life force coming in through the medulla, down through your nervous system, and into that body part. Or at the end, it'll be your entire body that's filled with that energy. So let's start with our left foot and tense it low, medium, high. Hold it. release and feel the life force coming through the medulla into your left foot. Your right foot tense low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Your left calf, low, medium, high. Release and feel. Right calf, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Left thigh, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Right calf, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Feel the medulla. If it's pulsating, that's good. If you feel the energy there, that's good. Other than that, image it. Your left buttocks, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Right buttocks, low, medium, high. Try to isolate those muscles as much as you can. Relax and feel. Lower stomach, try to take just a moment and see if you can locate those muscles there. Low, medium, high. Relax and feel the life force flowing. Upper stomach, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Left chest, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Right chest, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Left lower arm, low, medium, high. Let it vibrate. Relax and feel. Right lower arm, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Left upper arm, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Right upper arm, low, medium, high. Relax and feel the life force. Left neck, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Right neck, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Front of the throat, low, medium, high. Relax and feel. Back of the neck, low, medium, high. Hold, let it vibrate. Relax and feel. Now we're going to go quickly through all 20 body parts. Each time, instead of relaxing and feeling each one, you're going to hold them until your whole body is vibrating. You know, like one of those motel beds that you put the quarter into and it's all going to town. So left foot, low, medium, high. Right foot, low, medium, high. Left calf, low, medium, high. Right calf, low, medium, high. Left upper leg, low, medium, high. Right upper leg, low, medium, high. Left haunch, low, medium, high. Right haunch, low, medium, high. Lower stomach, upper stomach. Left chest. Left lower arm. Right upper, left, right lower arm, left upper arm, right upper arm, left neck, right neck, front of the neck, back of the neck, hold, vibrate. Relax and feel. You feel the life force coming in? You may feel tingly over your body. It's your life force. Good. Well, we're coming into what for the Western world celebrates as the time of the birth of Christ. It's kind of interesting when you look at the history of it all that they think that if the shepherds were out and tending their flocks, as it says that they were, that it was probably closer to March than it was December. But I think probably because traditional celebrations oftentimes happened at the time of the winter solstice, that they probably combined the two. It's very interesting for those who are Christians and think that the whole thing is Christian. There's so many of these ceremonies and times of them that are connected with lunar cycles, solar cycles, with all kinds of imagery from other traditions. And some of them are just pure mystical. The Christmas tree, for instance, one time I was putting up the Christmas tree and looking at the lights, and I began to think about it. And I thought, you know, this Christmas tree is nothing but the spinal system. Sri Yukteswar said that in scriptures, when it talks about a tree, what it's actually talking about is our nervous system like a tree turned upside down. In other words, our brain is the root, and the root's going out from there. And then it runs down the trunk, which is the spine, the shishumna, as called in the East. And then branching out are all the nerves that go out, and those are all the branches. When you go through these spiritual experiences, you see in your inner vision these inner chakras lit up. And sometimes it's reflected here at the third eye point. You see them there. And so the Christmas tree is a symbol of all your chakras lit up. And when you think of it that way, it's quite lovely. It's a beautiful symbol. I'd like to read from a poem that I wrote the other morning titled Awakening. Morning sun reveals the light, dispelling darkness gloom. Wondrous warmth envelops the earth and wakens all the world. Clouds illumine golden hues to glow, revealing the glory of what is to come. Sounds heard at this early morn further unmask death's nightly dark. Contrasting with the sky dark blue, showing infinity's reach stretching all bounds. Of dense clod of clay bounding in space, taking eye and mind to vital essence. Unveiling yonder eastern morning star, bright silver shining door. Manifesting light from that distant fiery orb, bringing attention to single pointed intensity. When suddenly bursts upon the horizon's altar, sun's blazing light of lights, overwhelming, life-giving, illuminating, bringing comfort and guidance to wayfarers all. Wanderers of this earthly plane, hear this love's awakening call. See how distant light pierces darkening veil and leads you right to your perennial home. I will say that has both inner and outer meaning. From the Bible this evening, I would like to read from the Gospel according to St. John, chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shineth in the darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. The same came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He was not that light, but he was sent to bear witness of the light. That was the true light, which lighteth every man that cometh in the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name, which were born not of blood, nor of the will of flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory of as of the only begotten Son of God, full of grace and truth. And from St. Matthew, chapter 1, beginning with verse 18, or 17, excuse me. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David until the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations, and from the carrying away into Babylon into Christ are 14 generations. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise. When as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Ghost. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man, and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privily. But while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou son of David, fear not to take thee Mary thy wife, for that which was conceived in her is of the Holy Ghost. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now all this was done, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which, being interpreted, is God with us. Then Joseph, being raised from sleep, did as the angel of the Lord had bidden him, and took unto him his wife, and knew her not till she had brought forth her firstborn son, and he called his name Jesus. Now Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. Behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he that was born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him. When Herod heard these things, the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. And they said unto him, In Bethlehem of Judea. For thus it was written by the prophet, O thou Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah. For out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Then Herod, when he had privily called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. And he sent to Bethlehem and said, Go and search diligently for the young child. And when you have found him, bring me word again, that I may come and worship him also. And when they had heard the king, they departed, and lo, the star which they saw in the east went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed into their own country another way. And when they were departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeareth to Joseph in a dream, saying, Arise, and take the young child and his mother, and flee into Egypt, and be thou there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. When he rose, he took the young child and his mother by night, and departed into Egypt. And there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which is spoken of the Lord by a prophet, saying, Out of Egypt I have called my son. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. Then was fulfilled by which was spoken by Jeremy the prophet, saying, In Ramah there was a voice heard, lamentation and weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and would not be comforted, because they are not. But when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeareth in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, Arise, take the young child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for they are dead which sought the young child's life. And he arose and took the child and his mother, and came into the land of Israel. Now, in all good parable, in all good stories, there are multiple levels of meaning. When Yogananda wrote about the life and the teachings of Jesus, the Christ, he wrote primarily as an individual, that Jesus was an individual who wandered the earth, who had a teaching, and he universalized those teachings, making them not just for those who profess Christianity, but for all mankind. Mother, through her experiences in India and then when she returned here, was shown an inner meaning. Now, this might be said that Master talked about as the outer meaning that was truly spiritual and truly universal. But Mother took it to the inner meaning, that is, to the consciousness and to the body, that actually these events being described here are the description of what happens in every human being in their evolution from the human to the divine. It says in the first John, as I read, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. Now, in a human sense, you can say that the Word was made flesh in terms of one human being. That's how it's traditionally interpreted. But the inner meaning is that the Word was made flesh, all flesh. That means you and me and all of us. That the Word, which was that creative power that went into creating this whole vast universe, it created everything, and without it, nothing was created, created us also. And so this is a tremendous story of the human evolution, of your evolution and mine. This descent that started with the Garden of Eden, as Adam and Eve made a choice to come into this material creation. Now, Adam represents reason, and Eve represents feeling. And they are seduced by this serpent force. Now, the serpent force is the life force that exists within the spine. And the lower nature of the body tempts us. In other words, when we exist in the higher centers of the body, in the heart center, in the throat center, in the medulla or the ajna, and at the crown center, we are in universal existence. We feel the prompting of God. We feel our oneness with God, the universal creative spirit. And we are part and parcel of that. There is no difference. But this force tempts us to go down into the body, goes down into the lower regions. Now, this is symbolically the sexual force that draws us to the furthest reaches of the human body. Now, why is sexual energy so important this way? In this sense, that through sexual energy, we look for our complement outside of ourselves. We look to find our complete and total union in another person. Now, from a spiritual standpoint, this is antithetical to the spiritual search. Now, I'm not saying here that sexuality or sexual acts are bad, but I'm saying that when they preoccupy the consciousness and they become the sum total of consciousness, that everything that we know is through the senses, then that becomes the opposing force within us. That when we turn our sight spiritually upward, then we seek to guide this life force up through the spine and into these higher centers and begin to awaken them. When we do this and we finally come face to face with that divine essence within ourselves, then we find that sense of completeness within ourselves. Through sexual union, we can achieve some state of union for a matter of moments, perhaps, where the ego boundaries totally collapse between two people. But afterwards, we return back to our normal consciousness, and the seeking starts all over again. In spiritual consciousness and spiritual awakening, this union is found right within us. And the human mind finds it hard to believe that that can be true. It thinks, well, you know, that's just something you do on Sundays, or that's just something you do in church, or, you know, they'll just fuddy-duddies do that kind of stuff. That's not for me. Without realizing the dynamic power that exists within each one of us, the incredible possibility for this union that is beyond anything that can be known in a human sense. The yogis describe this in a human sense as having 10,000 orgasms all at once to have this spiritual union with God. And they are trying to convey here the tremendous power, the tremendous upliftment, the tremendous bliss, and the sense of human union that can occur through this kind of experience. So through all of these battles, through all of these lives that are recorded in the Old Testament, they are all talking about the consequences of karma. They are lessons in the consequences of karma. They are also talking about the upliftment that happens when the spiritualized consciousness begins to occur within us. Jesus makes reference to Moses and says, even as Moses lifted up the serpent in the desert, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up. That is to say that Moses raised this serpent force up within himself and had this tremendous realization. He saw there the burning bush. Now the burning bush is this body. But it is this body when it has come on fire with this fire of kundalini force within us. And this is the purifying force that uplifts us, purifies the nervous system, and totally transforms us from a human creature into a divine expression. The New Testament, Jesus' story, is the ultimate union. It is the giving up of self, or this individualized self, this human self, this part of us that has seen itself as separate from the whole and goes into its total union with the one infinite source. So this is the beginning. Now, this birth that takes place between Joseph and Mary is the virgin birth. And what Mother realized within her own being is that it represented the secretions of two important glands within the brain. You see, it not only describes what happens in the consciousness, but also what happens physiologically within the body. These Jewish masters were great spiritual masters, and because of that, they could realize what was going on within their own body systems. Now, the Joseph gland is the pineal. The Mary is the pituitary. And they do not come together. In other words, there is no physical union. One has a milk-like secretion, the other honey-like secretion. And they come together and form a Christ seed. Now, this happens right within our own body, and it happens every 28 and a half days. When you come to that place where you want God realization more than anything else, then when that secretion happens, that droplet, that Christ seed, goes down the ganglionic nervous system and is deposited in a cave, a area of the body that's cave-like, just behind the stomach. Now, Bethlehem means house of bread. And so this seed is deposited there. So the birth happens there, at the house of bread. Now, these three wise men come and they worship. What are they following? They are following the star that is seen in the east. They don't say that the wise men are necessarily from the east, although it says that too, but it says they saw the star in the east. Now, the body is broken up into four quadrants. And at the base of your spine is the south. At the front of your body is the east, or this ajna center here at the point between the eyebrows. The medulla at the back of the head is the west. And the top at the crown chakra is the north. And there are several places in the Bible where it refers to directions. And what they're actually referring to are your own physical body. So in this case, this seeing the star in the east is seeing the spiritual light here at the third eye point. Now we're taught the spiritual eye technique, where we are taught to see the spiritual eye manifesting itself there. And it comes as a silver light, and it can be a five-pointed star that's there. And this is the star of the east. Or in the Native American tradition, it's the morning star. You see, all across the world, we see traditions, mystical traditions, that speak to these same truths all over. So this is born here at the third eye point. Now, what God showed me around this generations, there are 14 generations from Abraham to David, and 14 from David until the carrying away into Babylon, and 14 generations from carrying away of Babylon into Christ, or another 14 generations. Now, when we are made in the image and likeness of God, the image is this projection of the thought idea, the astral body, and the physical body. We have seven primary manifestations of light within us, and these are the chakras, which means wheel in the east. And so the first manifestation is the idea body, and that comes out. And then is the astral, and then is the physical. And so when this physical body is created, this is the first 14, or seven by polarity, so that there is good and evil, there is light and dark at everyone except for the seventh chakra. And that there combines the two positive and negative poles, like the yin and yang sign of China that combines the light and the dark. So the Sahasrara, or the seventh chakra, combines the two. So you have the physical manifestation. Then you are lifted up into David consciousness. Now, David means beloved. And the beloved exists in the heart. The heart is the seat of this energy body. And it's there that this purification begins. And then the last is this last creation, this last 14 generations, and that is of the idea body. And this is where the Christ is born, because it is closest to that purity of the essence of spirit. So the Christ seed comes down the ganglionic nervous system to the house of bread and is deposited there. Now, it is at that point that Herod comes up. Now, Herod represents the passions. And when you go into this experience, the passions come up in a terrific way. Even if you felt fairly neutered before that point, the passions will come to you so powerfully and so strongly that you don't even know whether you can contain it or not. But if your desire for God is there, then you will hold that seed at that time. You will not expel it out, but you will hold it. And if you can pass that test, then eventually Herod dies, or the passions begin to die down. And the Christ seed is hid in Egypt. Now, Egypt is the land of darkness, and it is at the base of the spine. It's the first chakra there. And so if you can hold that seed at that point, then that seed begins its upward journey, and that is the Galilean. That is the Galilee, which means the circuit. And this is the Sea of Galilee and the River Jordan. Both are expressions of this Shushumna, or this channel up the middle of the spine where the spinal fluid flows. That's why in India, the Ganges is considered sacred. It's symbolic of this inner river flowing within us, that is this fluid that flows within our own spine. The River Jordan is done for the West, and that is what's considered sacred there. So Herod the passions come up and try to kill all the children, and this death of the children is the expulsion of this desire to kill off and cut off all the heads of the children. Now, it's very interesting. When you look into the scriptures of the East, it's identical. When Krishna is born, the king, Kamsa, is told that this new child will be the new king being born. And Kamsa doesn't want that. So he seeks to kill that Christ or that Krishna child as it comes out, but is not able to do so, and in a rampage goes out and kills all the children in the land that are 2 years and younger. Does that sound familiar? These things are universal. As a matter of fact, it's said that Jesus, during the missing 18 years between his 12th birthday and his 30th, where there's nothing recorded of him, that he traveled to these different countries. Now, we know that he traveled to Egypt, and Egypt had a terrifically in-depth mystical tradition. Now, in Egypt, the king wore a crown, and in that crown had a serpent coming out right here at the forehead and coming out. This is symbolic of this risen serpent force that is the uplifted man that goes from the Son of Man to becoming the Son of God. Now, this scripture told us that every man has available to him to become the Son of God. It's not just one individual, but it's every one of us, on those who will take the time and the commitment and the energy in order to make this spiritual pursuit, can realize this tremendous truth within you. And then once realizing it, then you are free to explore all the other realms. But until then, we have to have a single-minded focus on realizing this truth. But who wants it? You know, of all the ones who say, yes, oh, I'd love to have that kind of experience. But who really wants it? Who's willing to sacrifice and to go all the way and to develop that kind of intensity? So once Herod, the passions, die down, then this Christ seed begins to rise and saying, arise and take the young child and his mother and go to the land of Israel. Now, the land of Israel are those upward forces. In Judaism, it's said that Jews are the chosen people. Now, the inward symbolic meaning of this is those are the upward forces. Every one of us is made of mixed nature. There is that part of us who wants to spiritualize our lives, who wants to become pure, who wants to experience the divinity of God within themselves. And then there is that part of us who wants to go out and explore this world more, wants to taste more of what the senses have to offer, has that desire nature that wants to be expressed out into this world. And so this is the upward and backward forces. When the Israelis, or the Jews, come up against the Philistines and the different opposing forces, this is representative of the battles that we all go through. And even when we have pure intent and we want nothing more than to satisfy our spiritual need and to find God, this is a terrific battle. There is no doubt about it. There is a terrific price to pay in going this full way to realizing this Christ or this Krishna consciousness or this Buddha awareness. You see, all the religions are speaking of the same thing. Lao Tzu spoke of it also. And so this is where we get into this back and forth battle. And it's not clean, and it's not a straight line. Now, we are told to make straight way the way of the Lord, for the day has come when he will be here. Now, this was said 2,000 years ago. It was said 3,000 years ago. And it can be said today. They are not talking about some outward event that will take place for the whole world. The world is this body. It is your body. This is your world. And it is your consciousness. But most people's consciousness are filled with worldly consciousness. So this is your world. And your world, when it is receptive and looking for the Savior force within you, opens the heart and the mind and the will towards fulfilling and satisfying spiritual need. And so it's in this way that the birth of Christ comes in you and in me and in all of us, if we would but take the trouble for it. So you see, this is a tremendous archetype for all of us. And there's great comfort in there, because the Son of Man is very strong. The Son of Man must be crucified. Or in other words, the Son of Man, the human tendencies, must be mastered in order to enter into the purity of spiritual consciousness. Now you might well ask, well, why do I have to give up being human? Didn't God create that also? Isn't that part of who I am? And the answer is yes, of course. It's all part of divine creation. But as long as we are identified solely as being, as being human beings, as being this human nature, then we have no room for this divine nature. God gives to us whatever it is that we desire. And if in our desire nature we desire these human fulfillments, then that's what he arranges for us. That's what he gives to us. And as long as that's the predominant need inside of us, then that's how we are fulfilled. But when we come to the point of really wanting the spiritual nature, the spiritual consciousness, and we see that this world has some lovely things to offer, but ultimately it does not have to offer what we want. What we want is this spiritual nature, and we want it so badly that we're willing not to give up whatever in order to know that. And we're willing to surrender ourselves completely. Then we come to that point where we can really start this spiritual journey. There are those who dabble at this and do a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and sometimes I think of them as workshop junkies. You know, they go to whatever workshop is coming through town. But they never really truly stick with anything until they see the results. They dabble. Now, I think of people coming in three different levels of consciousness. One is as a visitor. And when a visitor comes, you should treat them graciously and kindly. Serve them a little tea, maybe a little food like tonight, and have some nice conversation, and then they go their way. They're a visitor. Then there are those who are shoppers. They're looking for something, but they're not sure whether they've found it yet or not. And so they're dabbling a little bit here and there, but they're interested. They're not just a visitor. And then there are buyers. There are those who come and they recognize something different. They recognize a truth They come to an understanding. And they recognize that this is a way for them to achieve their oneness. Now, when we want to pursue any field of study, as we move from, say, a bachelor's degree to a master's degree to a PhD, that field of study becomes narrower because you can't be a generalist at those higher degrees. You focus your mind on a specific area. When you want to get a master's degree in spirituality, then you come to a path that seems to fit for you. And when you find that, then you dedicate yourself. And in this way, you make the best efficiency of what you've got, of your energy, your intelligence, your time. And you focus your attention in that way, and you stick with it. And you go clear to the end. And like any other degree, like any other endeavor, there are times when you feel like quitting. There are times when you feel like you can't go on. There are times when you need breaks. But deep in your heart, deep in your soul, you know that this is the way for you to go. And so inwardly, always attuned consciously, you're always working towards that goal. And sometimes the progress doesn't seem so rapid. Sometimes it seems like it's so much you can't bear it all. And so it's a little bit like the weather, you know. We're always complaining it's too cold, or it's too hot, it's too much of this or too much of that. And so in our spiritual life, sometimes we're complaining because not enough is happening, and other times we're complaining because too much is happening, and on and on. So the thing to do is to surrender, is to learn that God has placed you exactly where you're at, and that there is a purpose in that. And that this life is designed perfectly for you. And whoever you're in association with, wherever you find yourself going, that is the perfect plan for you. And if God puts it in your heart, the desire to seek Him out first, Master said, God has everything but your love. God cannot demand that love from us. He has given us free will, every one of us. And so, He has everything in this vast universe, except for that one thing. We can determine where we put our attention, where we give our love at, where we give of our life, of ourselves. And as much as we may be yearning for God, God, for all this time that we have wandered, has yearned for us. For God is only complete when we and all of creation are singing and dancing in union with that one complete consciousness. But we should remember, we chose as individualized consciousness to come into this material creation. And so we have chosen, and through this desire nature, we have linked ourselves to life after life after life. So if you have that desire for God alone, then that desire too must be fulfilled. And when that becomes your overriding desire, and all other desires are seen in the light of that one desire, then you will have Him. Now when you recognize that all pursuits for pleasure, all pursuits for accomplishment, whatever it may be, is really your desire for spiritual fulfillment, then you will see all desire as manifesting from that one desire, and then you spiritualize everything that you have. If you desire to build a beautiful home or to decorate it, that is your spiritual nature at work. And you can let that light shine out through you and build a beautiful home and decorate it beautifully after the nature of your own spirit. And that becomes a manifestation of your spirit. So you see, we don't need to divide up our life and say, this is for God and this is for myself. It is all part and parcel of the one same manifest consciousness. So it's in this way that we can get true and lasting happiness. I wanted to read you something. This is from Yogananda, from a book entitled Journey to Self-Realization. Chapter entitled The Omnipresent Consciousness of Christ and Krishna. And this talk was delivered December 18, 1939. With the coming of Christmas and the new year, resolve to follow a new mode of life. Seek communion with the Lord every day. The best way to find God is through technique. There is a method to everything we study, and religion is as much of a scientific discipline as our medicine and mathematics. So also is yoga, or union with God, a science of spiritual techniques. India's divine teachings were sent here by God-realized masters in communion with the great saints and Christ. On the universal path of self-realization, there is no reason and no room for prejudice and division. For through one's own self-realization, we come to know there is but one God and that we are all His children. The war that is coming will more and more testify to the folly of man. Let us pray that all nations cease from useless and senseless war and work instead to pave the way for a united world. You can save America only by being spiritual, and save yourself above all by meditation. Once in a while, you must get away from the world and meditate. Make use of your time to seek God. I am telling you today of the omnipresent Christ, or Krishna consciousness, through which He may be found. An ordinary man is conscious chiefly of sensory impressions. He sees through his eyes and hears through his ears, and gradually he expands his mind by reasoning about the reports of the senses. Man has great mental powers if he would develop them. Although he is tied to his body, by his intelligence he can stretch his imagination to the heavens. He can discover that the light of a star, which has been dead millions of years, is still traveling to reach the earth. But no matter how he develops mentally, man is still subject to limitations of his physical body. If a stone hits him, he is finished. Jesus proved by his spiritual development a great scientific truth. The body is indestructible energy. It is not the physical solid that it seems. By modern definition, the physical vehicle of a man is essentially an electromagnetic wave. If the body of an under 180-pound man were placed in certain acids, it would dissolve completely. Where would it have gone? Seemingly evaporated, that body would have become a mass of gases. Its total atomic weight would still be 180 pounds. The only difference when a body has been broken up into its components, atoms, is that you cannot see it anymore with physical eyes. Only scientific instruments can detect its presence as atomic vapors. The disappearance of the body does not mean that it has become non-existent. It has merely changed form, remaining hidden somewhere in the ether. Metaphysically, the body may be viewed as a thought in the mind of God. It exists in His consciousness in much the same way as it exists in our consciousness when we behold it during the dream state. Our dreaming consciousness creates a body form of concentrated thought and energy. It vanishes when our consciousness re-enters the turbulent waking state. Jesus had attained that consciousness wherein he knew, by direct realization, that the body is only a mass of energy. Because he has realized this, not merely imagined it, he was able to construct his body after its crucifixion. Earlier, when one of his followers had cut off an ear of a servant of a high priest, Jesus put his hand on the wound and made the ear whole again. Modern science has yet to discover how this is done. The ultimate goal is to realize that the body and all else in this universe is essentially spirit. The ordinary man is not aware of this. Jesus the Christ was. And at the end of the chapter, my greatest wish for you is this. May the love and perception of Christ come into your consciousness. He waits to receive but one Christmas present, the gift of your love. Tie it with golden strings of devotion, and on Christmas Day, you will find Christ Himself has come to receive it from you. Once He accepts your love, He gives Himself unto you. That gift shall be everlasting. And if you receive Him as Christ consciousness, even when all the gifts of this earth are gone, you shall be immortal, safe in the bosom of Christ and Krishna. You know, once there is a monk who is wandering. I don't know why this story just came into my mind. And he came upon this gem, this valuable jewel. And he gave not much thought to it. He thought it was pretty, and so he put it into his bag. And he was a wandering ascetic, so he wandered from place to place. And one day, a man that he met along on the road said, "Let me look up your bag." He said, "Certainly." He unpacked the bag, and he saw there this incredible jewel. He says, "Give this to me." Well, as he demanded, the monk said, "Certainly, take it, it's yours." So several days passed by, and the monk is wandering more, and suddenly the man, breathless, who had taken the jewel, shows up, and he says, "At last I found you. I've looked for you for days now." He says, "Here, take this jewel back, and give me that which allowed you to give this jewel away so easily." See, that's the spiritual treasure. And if we attune our mind and our heart and our consciousness to that, then we will know. You know, if you want to know if something's really valuable in this life, imagine the point of departure from this lifetime. Your body's laying in a coffin someplace and it's turned to skeleton. Your soul has risen up and joined into spiritual essence. And from that lofty height, somebody knocks on your coffin, you know? So you open up the coffin, say, "What do you want? I'm resting here peacefully." They say, they are saying all kinds of things about you. "Come out, defend yourself." "No, no, 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 I'm here peacefully. Don't bother me any longer. What does it matter to me what they say about me? I am with my Heavenly Father now." So think about that moment when you're lifted up in soul consciousness and you find yourself in that sublime presence of the ever-present Lord. And then think to yourself, "What does my life really count for?" My guru once asked me, she says, "What will you do to pay for the air that you breathe?" I didn't have an answer for her. That's a big question. I suppose it requires a big answer. I think I'm still trying to find the answer to that. I don't know. How will we pay for the air that we breathe, for the life that we have, for this incredible gift? What are we here for? Is it just to satisfy ourselves? Or is there something greater? Don't you feel within yourself that you're born for something greater? And what greater thing could there be than to realize your oneness with the ever-present Spirit within you, that God that went into creating you in the first place? Only you have forgotten it. You have fallen into amnesia. And because of that, you are like a king who's wandering as a beggar, forgetting that he is a king. So, rise up to that lofty state. Evaluate your life. Look at the trends in them. Are you making progress? Are you doing what you should to progress? Or are you making excuses for yourself? "Oh, I woke up this morning, but, you know, I was too tired to meditate, so I rolled over and went back to sleep." Or, "Yes, I would like to pursue something spiritually, but later in my life, you know, when I have more time." When will there be more time? Don't we fill our days up, our lives up, with nothing but busyness all the time? And yet, does it bring us true and lasting happiness? So let us begin today. Let us resolve that this is a special season. There is something wonderful in the air. And we might know that, that birth of that omnipresent Christ. Not just in one man, but that word that became flesh, it became you. And is you, and manifests you. And you can realize it. And you will know such joy, such upliftment, such peace, that you will scarce believe it. And you'll think, my God, my life before was but a dream. And now I feel I am truly awakened. That's what the Buddha means, is the awakened one. But it's not just one. He came not only to awaken his own consciousness, but to awaken all consciousness. Yours, mine, everybody's. But not all channels, not all antennas are attuned to that channel. You know, we're all a bit like a television receiver, antenna. And we can tune into different channels, and we choose. And the chakras represent all the different channels. And we can tune into the heart and feel their universal love, compassion. We can tune into the lowest chakras and tune in only towards sex or towards gaining empowerment in this world or getting our way. Those are all things that are possible. We're given free will. We can do as we choose. But weren't we put here for a greater purpose? Don't you feel that inside of yourself? So if you do, let's join together. And let's turn our attention inward and find there that dwelling, that most highest indwelling presence. And learn to attune ourselves to it morning, noon, night. Everywhere, always. Going to stop there and see if there's any further discussion, any questions or comments. You're all practicing this, yes, you're all. Hi.
The last thing you said reminded me of an experience I had last week when I came out of the Carnegie Jam, which is 4 hours of intense diplomatic negotiation between musicians. And as I walked across the street waiting for the bus, I became conscious of my own presence. And I thought to myself, right, during all the time I was in there, doing all of that stuff, I completely forgot who I was.
Yeah. For most of us, awakening is gradual. Sometimes you hear or read or even know those who just came in a sudden something. Meher Baba was walking down a road and a Mohammedan woman saint came out and hugged him and bam, he was there. Now, he wasn't very balanced, and that took years for him to get balanced. But he was totally uplifted in spiritual consciousness from that moment forward. That's not the case with most of us. With most of us, it's a gradual awakening. When we first start on the spiritual path, we get an experience or two to kind of, you know, a little carrot along the way to keep us going. And there comes a time when that spiritual consciousness comes alive in us somehow. We start getting it on a more constant basis. And it comes to us through the day. We might be thinking of something totally involved in work or conversation or something, and suddenly this presence comes into us, and we feel it, and we feel the upliftment of it. Now, it's oftentimes the easiest time to feel that when we're sitting in quietness, when we're meditating, when we dedicated our that moment towards realizing that. And the moment we get up and start walking around and the telephone rings and we get dressed and we run off to work or school or whatever, and we lose that. And so this awakening requires us to continual remembrance. And in as much as we can, we don't separate out our days and say, well, this is my work time, this is what I have to do for the world, and this is my meditation, this is my spiritual time. Your work is your meditation while you're doing it. And so when you enter into it, you carry with you your all, your mind, your heart, your spirit, every bit of part. And why leave any part of it behind? But we do that. And we do it on a consistent basis. And so the thing is to bring that remembrance with you. And it happens. And then you'll find that you're able to carry on a conversation with somebody. And you can hold that presence through the whole conversation. And that's a milestone. You've started to achieve something. And then you go into your work world and your day just flows. You have one of those days where you're in the flow. And everything moves and you're aware of that presence through much of the day. Then somebody says a cross thing to you. They're angry with you or what, and boom, you're right back in the body again. But gradually, as you dedicate yourself towards attuning your consciousness to the spiritual, you become imbued with that, and that becomes your predominant sense of yourself. And then, except for the most intense moments of concentrating on this particular project or that, you have that presence with you. And as soon as you're done with that, then you withdraw back into that presence again. Ultimately, you come to that place where whatever you're experiencing is a part and parcel of that consciousness. There is one saint that was asked, well, what's the difference? Here, before you were realized, now you are realized. So what's the difference in your life? And he said, well, I'll tell you. Before I was realized, there was times when I was happy and there was times when I was sad. And now, after realization, there's times when I'm happy and there's times that I'm sad. In one way, the consciousness continues to have this vacillation, because when you live in this world, there's a certain degree that you have to invest yourself or you couldn't be here. But the difference is that you realize that it's all but a play on the screen of spirit. And everything is an expression of that spiritual consciousness. And even your moods, now granted, your moods tend to even out. You're not dominated, you're more in control of that. But nevertheless, everything is a play on that screen. And so then you realize that everybody is doing that. And whether somebody comes to you and they're cross, or whether they're happy, or whether they're expressing any of the thousands or millions of ways that we can express life here, that is divinity in motion, in life. And so you stop dividing up life. And if you see two people in conflict, and before maybe you got scared inside and you withdrew, or you got energized because you wanted to enter into it too. But there's that part of you that's the spirit that witnesses all of this and sees it all as a play. And all is the same. And so more and more you carry that with you. And those things that are triggers for you, that tend to root you into your body, that take you away from spiritual consciousness, you gradually work your way through them. And they no longer hold a power over you. There's a Japanese saying that says, let's see if I can remember it correctly here. Noise doesn't disturb you. You disturb the noise. Let's say that you're in a place, apartment maybe, and you're trying to meditate. And there's some carpenters that are next door who are hammering and sawing on something. Now, you're not disturbing that noise. You see it as the noise coming and disturbing you. But those people are doing a rightful thing. they're rightfully engaged in their labors. And instead of receiving that noise, somebody else may hear that noise and it just doesn't even bother them at all. Their concentration takes them right through it. Or they think to themselves, you know, it's wonderful, they're over there creating something good. And here's the vibration that's coming from that positive creation. See, they take it totally different. So the noise isn't disturbing them. That individual is disturbing the noise.
I'm trying to remember that.
Right. When you allow things, when you allow noise, for instance, to flow through you, you are being disturbed because you're receptacle to it. And you're receptacle to it because you are this mass. You've identified with the mass. But when you identify with the spirit, the noise can go right through you and pass right through you, and it doesn't affect you. Now, there may be times when it does affect you, and you want to move yourself out of that. But realize that that's your attachment. Now, I may hear some particular kind of music, and I go, oh, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard. Stop it, you know? It's somebody else's favorite music. Now, who's to say I'm right and they're wrong, or they're right and I'm wrong? It's how we've been programmed. It's our own personal preferences. It's all the rest of it. So realize that there's nothing that's absolute in the truth of that disturbance. Realize that's your own personal preference and it's your own attachment. And you may not change your personal preference, but you might rise above that disturbance. You might say, that's God too. At one time I worked with the mentally ill and I had this one lovely man, just a beautiful man, but he had tremendous psychosis. And there were times when he had these things happening. Police would come in his own mind and shoot him in the face. Things being done to his body, torture, all of it. He would stand within an inch of my nose and yell at the top of his lungs. And I'd just go right through my whole body. I just loved this man so much. I couldn't be scared or angry or upset with him at all. I felt so sorry that he was, you know, he would say, David, and he would just describe to me what was going on in him. And I just realized that he was trying to maintain himself the best that he could. And so, you know, I couldn't be upset with him or disturbed by him because I felt that way. So even if people are doing misdeeds, if you feel compassion for them, then you come at them in a very different way. That doesn't mean you agree with them or you think that what they're doing is going to offer up good results. You might even step in and try to stop them. But the way, the manner you do it with is very different when you're operating out of compassion than when you're in a mode of intolerance. The one, you stay free. The other, you get enmeshed. So ask yourself, do you want to enmesh yourself in that? Is that what you want to tie yourself to? I think usually the answer comes back pretty clearly, no, I want to stay free. So when we set up an opposition out here, then we've set up our own opposition. And then it requires us to be a warrior in our own war that we ourselves have created. So if we want to stay, we might choose to enter into that war, but let us stay free in doing it. So just continue to do what you're doing. The fact that you felt uplifted after the fact is a good thing. That means that your natural tendency kicked into gear. And so build on that. And gradually you'll be able to enter into those meetings. And even if people are picking up chairs and throwing at each other in the conflict, you'll see the fun of God in all of it. You might have to duck, you know. But you'll see it all as a manifestation of the Spirit. To the point where Gandhi, when he was shot, Namaste. Ram, Ram, Ram. All the way to the God, all the way to the ground. God, God, God. That's what he chanted with Ram. And so that consciousness was purified. And it said that if we die with God on the name of our lips, we'll go directly to God. But that cannot come without a lifetime of practice. One is the body has instinctive fear to it. So it takes a lifetime of practice. But more than that, we can live this life totally free. Without the bonds of our humanness, in cases. And then humanness becomes an expression of our divinity. Because we've mastered it. And then we can come in and we can manifest our humanness totally as an act of divinity. And that state is called Sahaja Samadhi. That is a natural state samadhi. And then the world's our oyster. Does that answer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Right remembrance. It doesn't mean remembering everybody's name or, you know, it means always remembering that presence. And that presence is so sweet. When you get that presence, it's sweetness itself. And it's not a chore. It's the most lovely thing we can imagine. It's like being in love, but being in love with the whole universe. You think how wonderful is being in love, you know, that first rush of love with the person. Think of seeing your beloved manifested through all the universe. It's marvelous. And living life is making love to your beloved everywhere, equally present. And it doesn't mean you're devoid of preferences, but it means that you're not encased by them. You're not trapped by them. Master used to talk about, he said when he first came to America, he got with people and he would have some coffee. And he would drink some coffee and he quite enjoyed the taste of coffee. And then one day he found there were no friends around and he was making coffee for himself. And he thought, that's it. I've gotten too attached to this. I said, no more coffee. That's the way he was. He liked to practice on things. When he noticed that some attachment grew greater importance, he cut it off. And it's a very good way to exercise our will. So that we can practice being free until to that point where we truly are free. And then coffee or no coffee, it makes no difference.
Are you saying he was focusing on the coffee more than people for a little period?
He noticed the dominance that it had in his mind. Mm-hmm. And even though it was a little bit of dominance, he didn't want anything. Mm. If you notice that desire nature tugging at you, cut it off, and then you're free. It's like cutting off an anchor, a dead weight. Mm-hmm. And then you're free to go wherever you want instead of always getting that tug to come back in that direction. So whenever he felt that tug, cut the chain.
And those are the desires, the physical desires, an example.
Right.
That you talk about.
Right.
Yeah.
And the more you let it, it's a little bit like a snowball that starts as a little tiny thing, but as it goes down the hill, it gathers momentum and size and mass, and,
like
you know.
Like going back to a habit, like cigarettes or
right.
anything.
Right.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Like the AA saying of one's too many and 1,000's not enough.
Yes.
You know, that's the way desire nature is.
Yeah.
There are some people who teach, well, you just fulfill desire nature. You know, you do whatever you want to and you fulfill it. Well, Krishna says it's like a rising tide. You give it a little bit and it takes on a whole life of its own. And that doesn't mean you have to become a prude or a prune, you know. You don't have to deny life. But when we notice that something's taking an extraordinary amount of momentum in our life, that's the time to cut it off. And let it go. And be free. Practice being free in that way.
Yeah, I like that advice.
You know, Mother liked ice cream sundaes. Root beer and Reese's peanut butter cups. You know, she didn't deny herself life. Uh-huh. And she would go to see a movie occasionally, and, you know, she lived life. She was in India one time, and there was one of the guides with them, and I don't know how they ended up there, but they were seeing a dancer, a belly dancer type person. And she hugely enjoyed it. You know, the woman was skilled in what she was doing. And the people around her felt a little scandalized by it all. But she was free from that. She would describe her consciousness. She says, I'm not a saint. Saint consciousness is wedded to one-sided duality. It's only for good. It's only this. You only do things in a certain way. She says, I have universal consciousness. Everything before me is God. So she is free. You can't escape duality. Gandhi, for all of his teaching of Ahimsa, and I think it's a wonderful teaching, but the thing that really coerced the other side when he would go on these fasts, the British for instance, was the threat of violence, because they knew if he died, the streets would erupt into violence. And so, ironically, it was the very threat of violence that made the other, that he was using, he himself using, in order to get an accomplishment. You cannot escape duality as much as you want to. Whenever you accept one side, the other side, the shadow is there. So the person in universal consciousness, you know, in the Mahabharata, Krishna, after the battles and everything, he's accused of lying. And they go down the steps, and he did. He did. But he says, I didn't. Because I was always focused on the light. Always on the light. And that was symbolized by Arjuna. And Arjuna was the light. And he was always focused on that light. And so, it doesn't necessarily mean that any means is justified by the end, but he was focused on that light, and therefore whatever he did in truth. That's a difficult concept for people who are wedded to just one side. Well, isn't that licensed to do anything? Well, if you have Krishna's consciousness, then you can do it with impunity. But, of course, we've seen different teachers from the East and some from the West who get into big trouble. Well, whatever I do is God. And so they do anything, and it's not. They have not purified their consciousness to the point where that's a truth. So Meher Baba said, do not tell lies about the truth your guru tells you. In other words, until you've realized it yourself, don't go around reporting it as truth until you realize it as truth. So that's the whole thing, is your realization.
I notice fear just, obviously it's like a cloud over light, you know, it just shuts down that whole presence.
Yeah.
You just don't feel it anymore, and then do you have any advice about working it through? What do you do to just keep going till the cloud lifts?
Yeah, fear, anger, greed, lust. Those are the four lions at the gate and keep us from entering in. One is to acknowledge no fear. Acknowledge to yourself, I am fearless, even when you feel fear. Behind the fearlessness, or the fear, is the fearlessness. One is you can just talk to yourself. Say, what really is there to be afraid of here? And walk yourself through. Take the next step, whatever it is. You know, for the person, my brother, in our early life, one time I accidentally stepped on a hornet's nest that was in the ground. Boy, they came out, they were mad hornets. They were protecting their place, and they went after everybody. Most of us took off running. My one brother just stood there. We said, run, run. He says, I can't, they're all over me. They're in my shoes, they're everywhere. He got hundreds of stings, I think. And so finally, he finally moved, and they ate enough of his flesh. They were tired of him, I don't know. But he finally got out of there. When we freeze, and that's a natural tendency to do when we get scared, is we freeze. And when we freeze, we keep ourselves in the very situation we're terrified of. Now, if we're walking through a dark part of the forest, a shortcut, and we get right in the middle of it, and we just stop, and we don't want to move, we don't help ourselves at all. We just stay there, we stay stuck, and we get more and more scared. But even when in our fear, if we can just take a step, and another step, and another step, and just focus on the next step, even in our fear, then we'll gradually walk out of that place. And we'll look back and we'll probably say, you know, there really wasn't too much to be afraid of there. But boy, it really got a hold of me. So even in the midst of fear, acknowledge its invalidity. As Sri Yukteswar says, an unwelcome guest, unacknowledged guest soon leaves. If you don't acknowledge it, it'll pass away. But fear can really grab hold of us in the spiritual. There's those four different qualities, and fear can really grab hold of us. So to just keep walking, the next step after the next. There is a Medal of Honor winner in the United States, and that's a Congressional Medal of Honor that's awarded only to the most brave people. And this winner was saying, you know what? He says, some people say, oh, you must not have been afraid. He said, it would be no act of courage if I was unafraid and did what I did. He says, I was terrified, but I felt I needed to do this, and it was saving some people. And so I went anyway. He says, I think that's real courage, and I agree with him. Being unafraid and doing something, that's no courage. Where's the courage in that? Being afraid and still moving forward, that's courage. So concentrate on your courage. Know that God is within you, and that God, when you invoke that consciousness, when you invoke that name, that will help you through. That will be your guiding force, your protecting force, everything you need. And so stand on that.
Is that what prayers are? In other words, the prayers invoking God's name, asking for help.
Yes.
Through it.
And what happens is you solicit a response from that highest consciousness, from that spiritual realm. When you put your focus of attention on it, and it works, then what you're getting is a response from that realm. And marvelous things can happen then.
Mm-hmm. In the Bible, it said, like you said, I am the way and the truth and the life. Don't ask from the Father, the Father but me.
Yes.
So, like, I have this, like, concern, like, when I pray, okay, who am I praying to? Like, if I pray and talk to the Lord, right, which
right.
Jesus to me,
right,
am I ignoring my Father or my Divine Mother, or do I have to go through the whole hierarchy? Or, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, the greatest truth is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. There is but one creative spirit and presence. Now you have to ask yourself, who or what was Jesus speaking of when he said that? For instance, when he said, before Abraham was, I am, what sort of person, what sort of consciousness, who was saying that? Was that Jesus?
All I know is Jesus said, I and my Father are one.
But think about it. Could Jesus, the Son of Man, say, before Abraham was, I am. It's purely impersonal. You know, who was saying that?
God.
What you have to realize is that these great masters speak from different levels of consciousness. And the highest level of consciousness is when they identify with that pure spirit. And when Jesus, the Son of Man, was identifying with that pure spirit, he could say such things. But so could you. So can every great master who's risen up above their humanity. It's the truth. There's also an inner meaning to that. This is the Christ consciousness within you. And it is entering in through this spiritual doorway here at the third eye point that is your Christ center. And so the way and the truth is here, right within you. These great masters speak from multiple levels of truth. But the materialistic West has looked at Jesus' teachings just as a human being living 2,000 years ago, and that's it. But look at the way that he spoke. When he is standing next to the temple and says, "Destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days." Now, it's natural for all the people standing around to think he's talking about this huge. They said it took 40 years to build it. You're saying you're going to build it in 3 days? It's ridiculous. He was speaking of his own consciousness, that if his body was destroyed, he could recreate it.
So that makes imminent sense, like the truth and the light is here.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So you have to realize who's saying that. If you take it as a material man, a lot of his statements will not make sense. But when you take it on the level that he spoke, then it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does. I always understood that if you prayed to God, you had to pray through Jesus.
Metaphysically, Christ consciousness, there's God the Father, who is pure spirit. Then God the Mother is God become manifest, spiritualized consciousness become energy consciousness, and then material consciousness. That's God the Mother. And the Christ Spirit, the Messiah, the Savior, is the pure essence of spirit unmanifest that sown is the firstborn of every creature, as St. Paul says. And if you get down to the very atoms, it's the firstborn of the atoms. Of every aspect of nature, it's the firstborn. And it contains that pure spiritual consciousness. And that is the Om. The Om has gone out and created, or the Amen, all this material creation. So, metaphysically speaking, the only begotten Son of God is this pure spirit. Now, when you're uplifted in consciousness, you can see this entire creation as but a manifestation of light. You're seeing Christ consciousness at that point.
What did you see the Om represented again?
That's manifestation of spirit. And when you hear that Om or that high-pitched sound coming in through the back of your head or through your right ear, that is the sound of the cosmic vibration.
So that's a gift, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And if you tune into that with your mind and allow your mind to expand with it, it'll expand your mind into universal realms. Also with the light here that you see. You see the white light of God there. Allow your mind, just allow it to go with that light. You know, expand wave after wave after wave. And along with it, your whole being.